Well, good afternoon. I don't think I'll use the 15 minutes to bring the hook out. A few years ago, some colleagues of mine in Israel and at Goddard Space Flight Center contacted me and said that they wanted to jointly work on a project of evapotranspiration estimation using biophysical modeling. At the time, we wanted to use a model called SIP2, which is a Peer-Sellers model, and we wanted to use MODIS because we could collect observations every other day. Well, for various reasons, a lot of that work didn't quite work out as well as we wanted to. One of the reasons of which is that the spatial resolution of MODIS isn't quite good enough for what we need to do, and it's definitely not good enough if you're using thermal infrared. So the outcome from that study is that I undertook, along with Doug Hunziker and Lauri Banua and Arnon Carnielli, we undertook a study in south central Arizona using primarily Landsat data, and I'd like to show you some model comparison work that we've done with this. It's not quite done, but it'll give you a pretty good picture of how things are working out. Here's the location of the study site. It's southeast of Phoenix and just north of Tucson, Arizona, and it's obviously an arid climate with less than 10 inches of rain a year. There, you can see there's not a mouse here, so I'll have to use the cursor here. It's a little awkward. But the water resources for central Arizona are from two places, groundwater, about 50%, and about 50% from the Colorado River through the Central Arizona Project over here from Parker, Arizona. Here's an enlargement of the Central Arizona Irrigation District. Well, why did we choose this area? Well, the fact is it's very difficult to get water use from farmers. They don't want to provide it for you, or they don't collect it at the details. But we had a long business relationship with the Central Arizona Irrigation District because a previous research leader, Bert Clemens, and others had done some canal automation work. So we had a lot of goodwill. So we were able to get some water use data. However, that water use data is at canal turnouts. So you have volumes, but you're not quite sure exactly where the water goes. So we have a constraint on water delivered, but not necessarily the total water volume that went in on a particular plot. But we thought this was good enough. This is good enough for validating evapotranspiration models. So this is just some outline of some of the facts about CAIDD, which is Central Arizona Irrigation District. It's a clay loam or fine sandy loam soil. It's about 35,000 irrigated hectares, which is about the same as an adjacent irrigation district in Maricopa. Dominant crops are cotton, alfalfa, and small grains. As mentioned, the water supply is either through the Central Arizona Project or through groundwater, about 50-50. In 2008, the deliveries were about 250,000 acre feet. There are about 200 miles of lined canals. 12 of the 27 canals are automated, which is part of the Bert Clemens project that I was mentioning. But this is the big issue, and why we even do remote sensing of ET. We want to know where we are now in terms of water use, where we're headed, and then you also want to know, what is my neighbor using? So in 2015, Lake Mead is going down pretty severely. A lot of the irrigation districts have made a voluntary reductions because they could see the writing on the wall. They needed to have a mechanism for gracefully reducing their water withdrawals, and they realized if they collaborated, that it would be more graceful than if they were told 1 year all of a sudden, well, you don't have anything. So that's sort of the motivation for why we're interested in irrigation in this part of the country. The particular study is we want to test the time series remote sensing of ET against those irrigation deliveries, as I mentioned, and evaluate the ET results from two remote sensing models that I used a lot, which is Metric and Two Source Energy Balance Model, TSEB, and then an NDVI-driven crop coefficient model that was mentioned this morning, but we have a little different take on how that's implemented. So we have really three sources of ET. We have an estimate from the water deliveries themselves. We have a crop coefficient model, which doesn't account for thermal stress, and then we have two models that are thermally driven. The two-source energy balance model, I owe a lot to John Norman, Bill Kustis, Martha Henderson, and Tom Schmugge for getting me involved in that model, and I've been a big fan of that approach for quite a few years. This model is a pretty closely physically driven model. It uses land surface temperature, say from Landsat, typically 60 to 120 meter resolution. It requires a near surface air temperature, not so easy to get. Vegetation indices, pretty easy to get. Crop height, crop type, that's a little tricky, depending on your region. And then the virtue of the model is that it partitions fluxes between soil and vegetation separately. And the discovery that John Norman Kustis made was that the transport resistance between soil and vegetation is different, so you need to parameterize them separately. And then the drawback, of course, is that the land surface temperature that you use has to be accurate. The metric model, which Rick Allen, you probably heard some of his talks, gives a very nice presentation. And initially, when I heard about the CBAL model, I guess I was just too partisan. I was too much of a follower of the two-source model to see it. But since then, I've become very fond of metric and the CBAL model, because what it does is it has contextual data. It doesn't rely on your accurate atmospheric correction so much as two-source does. So you use land surface temperature data in the same way you do from two-source. You do need some near surface air temperature data. You need vegetation indices, again, easy to get. But you don't have to have the crop type, although that would be useful, I think. It doesn't parameterize the fluxes separately in soil and vegetation. And what it does is it look, if you've heard his talk, you know it much better. And you look at hot and cold pixels represent fully transpiring surfaces and surfaces not transpiring at all. And so it's a nice model because you don't have to know a lot of ancillary data. The other model that we use a lot, and Doug Hunsaker, unfortunately, is not here for this meeting, but has been a big leader in developing this. And this is something that was started, really, I'd say, at Maricopa in the 90s, before I joined the group there. They did lots of field studies over various crops, and they had lysimeters, so they knew the crop water use. And they developed these curves, which you can see in the upper left. These are from field experiments. So the question that came up this morning is, how do you calibrate your crop coefficient versus your vegetation indices? Well, we've done this from lysimeter data and actual soil neutron probes, so we have in-plot measurements of that. And so that's a statistical base that we have. And then on the bottom is a typical remote sensing vegetation index curve, in this case for cotton, that we can collect and interpolate to a daily basis. And the end product of that NDVI KCB model is an FAO 56 driven by vegetation index resulting in the curves, the data in the bottom. And we think this is a pretty good result, because what it gives you is it gives you not just the crop transpiration, but it also gives you the evaporation, which are those spikes that you see early in the season. And that's something that remote sensing will typically miss. So what are the remote sensing data that I use? Well, it's pretty much NASA and USGS provided, and I owe a huge amount of thanks to their diligence and accuracy and ability, facility of accessing the data. We use primarily Landsat 5 and Landsat 7 because this is 2008. So nowadays you'd use Landsat 8. You can see on the lower right how the scanline corrector leaves those gaps, which causes a lot of grief in the data analysis, but that's something worth dealing with, because by combining Landsat 5 and 7, you can get 8-day observations. On the left are two satellite observations that we also use in the study a little bit. One is MODIS, because we get that every 2 days. We can't easily resolve individual fields because we have a 250-meter resolution, and if your registration is off a little bit, it becomes really tricky. But it gets you an idea of the long-term trends, so we used it for that. And on the lower left, we have ASTER, which we had a few of those. Not a good satellite for time series, but very good for accurate land surface temperatures, and we use that to assess the accuracy of Landsat 5 and 7 temperatures. Well, what did we get? Well, probably the easiest way to compare without being too critical, self-critical, is to look at the cumulative water over the various crops. We looked at cotton, sorghum, wheat, and corn. I'm only going to show you the cotton in this case, and then I'll show you the from beginning of the season to the pretty much senescence end of cotton season at end of September, early October. The green curve is the irrigation applications. Thank you. And the purple is derivative of the NDVI KCB curve. And so it's a little unfair to compare it with everything else because we had an idea of when the planting was done and we had a very good idea of when the irrigations were applied. With remote sensing, you might not know that. So we have a little bit of a log up, so when we compare these models, we have to recognize that there are some advantages that we give some models and not others. But you can see that the agreement between the actual irrigation and the NDVI model is pretty good if you account for the fact that about 10 to 12% of water has deep percolation. The other two curves, the red is the two-source energy balance model, and the blue is metric. Now, in the end of the season, it looks like two-source agrees most closely with actual water delivered and used by the crop, whereas metric looks like it's a little, you know, maybe about 50 millimeters under, something on that order. The purpose of running the two models is not to do a rodeo or competition. The purpose of the models is to lend credibility to the overall ET estimation, because you have two completely or three completely independent observations and you can gauge your uncertainty of the model. Well, when we look at individual day-to-day, this is where things get pretty messy. Now, we looked at alfalfa. Well, there's a lot of cuttings of alfalfa in Arizona. There are, you know, eight cuttings maybe, something maybe more. I don't know. I'm not a farmer, so I don't know, but I can detect at least eight a year in a lot of these. And so we did a side-by-side comparison with a two-source model, which is in red, and the metric model in blue. It looked like, on average, they agree quite well. They're using around 2 to 4 millimeters on these particular overpass days. But there's a lot of discrepancy that's hard to explain. And unfortunately, I can't explain that at this moment. The data results are too new. That just shows you that there's a lot of complexity to each of the models, and getting the degree in a linear fashion is not a straightforward thing. One last thing is that that's interested me is that the metric model requires a methodology for pixel selection, and it's been one of my criticisms, just self-criticisms of how you implement this model. With two source, it's very algorithmic, but in metric, there's some judgment. And Rick has always said, well, you need to be an expert. Well, I didn't really like that idea because I thought you need to have more objectivity to the model. So I implemented an automated pixel selection method, which is similar to the one that's just in literature this year. What I do is I select the pixels, set the cool, wet pixels first, and then I do a search radius. Other methods use just a global search for your hot pixels and then do your relationship. Well, what I found was that when you did this, that there was a very strong interdependence between the linear fit of the models, which means that this hot-cold pixel parameterization is really a single parameter model. And the other thing we found out was that there's a seasonal variation in the slope of that DT curve that calibrates it, and that's illustrated in the bottom here, where it shows during the summertime that the slopes of your DT relationship decrease a lot. And this is consistent across years. So I'd just like to leave you off at this point and say, well, we're working on the wrapping up the final analysis. It's a monumental job to bring together 39 satellite images, over a 60-kilometer region. We're using two main satellites and two ancillary satellites. We're looking forward to the day when we can have the Venus satellite, which was launched August 1st. We'll have day overpasses every other day. It'll have selected sites in the next year, but maybe that will be routine for all of us. so we'll be able to get vegetation disease very frequently, and that will assist us in improving our accuracy of ET estimation and forecasting. Thanks. Yeah, what I did was I used the cold pixel as an anchor, and then I decided how far away I wanted to search in a radius, and I looked at all the pixels within. In my case, I selected a 3-kilometer radius. It was just a number, but I mean, one would have to come up with a better rationale than just saying, well, that sounds good, but I didn't like the idea that you could generate your linear relationship between any pairs of points on your remote sensing image. I thought that there had to be a physical relationship between the end members. So I just wanted the hot pixel to be in vicinity of the cold pixel. And so what that meant was you chose a hot pixel was bare soil just across the road from a well-watered field. Well, you just said exactly what I have in the back of my mind, is that I think we become less partisan. We choose multiple models and we get a consensus. I think there's a lot of value in that, yes. Mm-hmm.